The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Frisch, Judge Connolly, Judge Cochran, the Honorable Jennifer L. Frisch presiding.
Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. Today is December 3rd, 2024. We have one case on our calendar this afternoon for oral argument, A240418, MEC Alti Inc. versus Hybrid Light Solutions. And counsel, you can correct me if I've mispronounced either of your clients' names. You are familiar with our proceedings. You'll each have 15 minutes for your primary argument. The appellant has an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal. You'll see the timer on the screen. Please make sure that you're paying attention to the time. We'll remind you if you are over your time. These matters are being recorded. That is the only recording that is permitted. I'd ask that you state your name and identify your client before you begin speaking and let us know how we can reference you this morning or this afternoon. And with that, Mr. Duncan, I believe you are first.
Thank you, Your Honor. Your Honor's counsel, may it please the court. My name is Greg Duncan, and I'm counsel for Appellant MEC Alti Inc. My client is the U.S. seller and distributor of electrical components manufactured by its Italian parent company. This appeal arises from a jury trial in Crow Wing County that took place in June of 2023 on respondent Hybrid Light Solution LLC's claims of breach of contract and breach of express and implied warranties. Those claims arose from allegations that a component DC alternator that Hybrid purchased from MEC Alti was defective and caused failures in Hybrid's portable light towers after they were placed in the remote and rugged oil fields of Canada by Hybrid's primary client, Zedcor. The jury found in favor of Hybrid on its breach of contract and breach of express warranty and breach of implied warranty of fitness for particular purpose claims, but not on its breach of warranty of merchantability. MEC Alti alleges several errors of the trial court in its rulings in pretrial and post-trial motions. It would be my intent to focus most of my time addressing the first two grounds for the appeal, which are the trial court's pretrial order dismissing MEC Alti's affirmative defense that its standard conditions of sale established the terms of its express warranty and disclaimed all implied warranties and lost profit damages. And the second issue is the court's rejection of MEC Alti's motion for judgment as a matter of law that Hybrid failed in its burden of proof on its claim that MEC Alti's alternators were defective or the cause of the failures, as opposed to some other cause, including Hybrid's own design. Hybrid's light towers are self-designed, and they use what Hybrid's own folks called off-the-shelf components from multiple vendors. MEC Alti supplied just one of those components in accordance with the only specifications given to it by Hybrid, that the component be a 10 kilowatt,
Counsel.
3000 RPM, 48 volt DC alternator. And MEC Alti supplied what they call the model AL3 that fit those specifications. It's what's known as a synchronous alternator, which has been sold since at least 2008, and according to undisputed testimony at trial, has a 0.05% failure rate.
So, Counsel,
Yes.
the panel has read the briefs and is familiar with the facts and the trial testimony and trial record. I think it, given the limited amount of time available, I'd like to turn to the first issue that you raised on appeal relating to the district court's grant of the motion in limine and your argument that that motion was really a de facto motion for summary judgment or partial summary judgment.
Certainly, Your Honor. The motion was according to the standards set in Hebrink, the motion was an improper summary judgment motion. The motion was actually raised by Hybrid in its trial brief. They raised two supposed motions in limine, one of which cited to various evidentiary rules, but the issue related to the standard conditions of sale was not addressed in any way according to rules of evidence. It was addressed based upon the Knoll transfer case, which was itself a case involving a motion for summary judgment. And the entire argument about that supposed motion in limine related to the what is an allowable disclaimer or allowable warranty disclaimer, and whether McAlty's standard conditions of sale met that on the merits based upon the trial testimony, the deposition testimony. And in
so
fact,
is this case distinguishable from the Hebring case in that here the district court granted the motion to exclude evidence related to the standard conditions of sale, whereas in Hebring, the district court sua sponte granted summary judgment?
I don't believe it is. I think this case is more alike Hebring than the cases cited by Hybrid, which were distinguished from Hebring. I think the facts of this case really stand on that there was no argument at all made by Hybrid that the standard conditions of sale were irrelevant or prejudicial in some manner. There was no reference to rules of evidence. It completely related to the
does the court's order actually grant summary a partial motion for summary judgment? Or I mean, is it a legal analysis in your view, or is it looking at the relevance of the evidence?
Sure, it does mention that the the request was that the court rule as a matter of law that the standard conditions of sale were not presented to Hybrid. The court may have not said partial summary judgment, but as Hebring notes, you know, the issue is whether it's tantamount to a summary judgment, and this is certainly tantamount to a summary judgment because it eliminated the affirmative defense, which Hybrid correctly pointed out, you know, that the burden of proof of the affirmative defense was on McAlty, and it eliminated our ability to prove that affirmative defense. And so it absolutely was a partial summary judgment.
Okay, assuming we were to agree with you on that point, and just assuming, I don't mean to speak even for myself, much less the other members of the panel, but, you know, does that defense go only to the warranty claims, or does it also go to the breach of contract claims? Can you help me understand that? Wasn't entirely clear in your briefing.
Well, I believe it goes to both because the standard conditions of sale included a language that would disclaim the exact type of damages that that Hybrid was seeking in both the warranty and the express and implied warranty claims and the breach of contract, which is lost profit. So it disclaimed both, and it set forth, I think, you know, the terms of the contract in terms of what they were supposed to provide, and so I do believe it would apply to both.
So then did you make an offer of proof as to the defense at trial?
We did not make an offer of proof. We brought the issue up repeatedly. The trial counsel brought the matter up in both in a kind of a request that it be reconsidered by the trial judge, as well as through our post-trial motions. Well, we didn't bring it up in a post-trial motion. We brought it up during trial, both at the start of the trial and kind of midway through the trial, before our case went on, I believe.
So in the absence of the offer of proof, what is the harm that we can discern from the evidentiary ruling, assuming that the evidentiary ruling was improper?
Certainly the harm is that it eliminated a key defense to McAlty to these claims.
Well, how do we know it's a key defense if there's no offer of proof?
Well, the standard conditions of sale were alleged in our answer. They were alleged. They were produced in discovery. They were provided in connection with the motions, and so they were part of the record. And so I believe that an ample record was made establishing the standard conditions and what they were prior to the court's ruling on it.
Is it enough just to argue that the defense is eliminated to show prejudice? Or it seems to me that our analysis would be instructed by Rule 61 of the Rules of Civil Procedure, which require a showing of that the district court's order affect the party's substantial rights. And without the offer of proof, how can we tell that your substantial rights are affected, particularly since in the response to the motion, the only evidence that McFaulty brought forward was that there was some deposition testimony that one of the employees thought John provided the information to Hybrid, but it was very vague. And, is that enough to show that your substantial rights were affected? Don't you need to show that there's, it's that the evidence might reasonably have changed the result of the trial if it had been admitted, which is the Supreme Court standard in Papphagen?
Well, I think Your Honor, the substantial harm in court under Hebrink is the inability to provide a meaningful opportunity to respond to the motion. And the timing of the motion is significant, where this was brought, as essentially a summary judgment motion, but, shortly before trial, that there was nothing. There was no evidence in that motion that would, other than kind of the allegations and representations of counsel, there was no meaningful opportunity to respond to the allegations that this was to the merits of the claim. Yeah,
I don't recall you making that argument in your brief. I thought you were arguing that it was more the failure to comply with the rules by themselves required reversal, and in your response to their motion at the district court level, it appears, or McAulty's response at the district court level, McAulty did kind of respond to the motion as if it were a de facto summary judgment motion. So I guess it's unclear to me, how McAulty was denied a meaningful opportunity to respond and what additional information would have been provided had it had that opportunity. I don't see any argument in that regard in your brief, but maybe I'm wrong.
Yeah, I believe it's in there, Your Honor. I believe we had argued that the timing of it, with the fact that motion really had no evidence attached to it. There was no affidavits. There was nothing there. We discussed that. We discussed that that we did not have an opportunity to respond. There was some response in connection with a different motion, a motion that we brought regarding the standard conditions of sale. But that was an entirely different motion. The Hybrid responded to that motion with some additional supposed facts that they were relying on. And again, we didn't have any. It was more akin to a reply. Sorry, Your Honor.
No. Finish your thought, and then I have a question too.
No, go ahead, John.
So, would you agree that if these standard conditions apply, they had to be provided to Hybrid?
It's as to the merit of that. I mean, that's the Noel transfer case in the law that's cited in there. I believe that they would have to provide that. I think there was a factual
you would
as
have
to whether
to
it was
that.
Or was not.
Okay. Well. Then let's. Do you agree that the only testimony as to whether they saw these conditions on the website is Weber's testimony? Do you agree with that?
I agree with that, and from a discovery standpoint. But when that claim is decided, then we don't have an opportunity to call those witnesses to testify at trial. We don't know what they would.
No, I got it. But let's say the sake of argument, and I'm not sure I agree. Either with myself that this was a summary judgment motion, but one of your arguments is, well, there is this material fact in dispute, and that's why summary judgment shouldn't have been granted, among your other reasons. And and I understand all references in favor of the party opposing the motion, but Did you ever direct Hybrid Light to the warranty information on your website? Myself, personally, I don't think so, but I'm sure John did, you know. So you're relying on, but I'm sure John did, you know, as to create a material fact in dispute? Would that be a fair
I believe that's true, Your Honor. I mean, I think that is a material.
It would if he had said John did, well, then I agree. You know, that's clear, but I'm sure John did. I mean, isn't that sort of just pure speculation? And I don't know if, you know, the inferences include favoring pure speculation. So why am I wrong?
Well, I think that you're weighing what, you know, the credibility.
I'm not. Well, first of all, I'm not weighing anything.
I think the trial judge.
I'm reading the transcript, not. But I'm saying, even if that's true, even if what he said is true, is that enough? And I'm not so sure it is. So why? How does I'm sure John did create a material fact in dispute, as opposed to simply being pure speculation, which doesn't create a material fact in dispute, even if I give you all the inferences in favor of you?
Well, I think we don't really know what he would have testified at trial because, you know, he.
Well, if this was summary judgment, though, there, you know, there would have been no trial. So what I'm saying is how does this even get you to win this so-called defective summary judgment motion or defeat the so-called defective summary judgment?
Your Honor, I mean, we never had an opportunity to provide any evidence that would have countered that, and didn't have the opportunity to provide that information going forward. And I don't think that I think that.
So,
that
so
is,
you're saying
I
at trial,
disagree. I think that is about,
Mr. Weber would have been better coached then.
Not coached. I wouldn't have. Mr. Weber wouldn't have been
enlightened.
Coached,
but he would have been enlightened.
Maybe, he could have maybe elaborated on what he.
Let's
meant.
Go with elaborated then. Okay, thank you.
Mr. Duncan, you'll have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal if you choose to use it. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
We'll hear from counsel for Hybrid Light.
May it please the court, Scott Flaherty for respondent Hybrid Light, LLC. In this breach of contract case, the jury carefully made credibility determinations and weighed the evidence. We know the jury was careful because McAlty prevailed on one of the three theories before the jury. This case was factually simple from the jury's point of view. McAlty made a promise. That promise was breached, and Hybrid suffered damages from it. That verdict should be affirmed. And the three issues that McAlty raised on appeal don't have merit. The trial judge did not abuse her discretion in excluding evidence, and the motion to exclude that evidence was not a summary judgment motion. The evidence the jury heard was sufficient to support its findings, and neither the verdict nor the verdict form were inconsistent. The only real substantive question before this panel is whether the court's affirmance should be precedential or non-precedential. This panel can, of course, follow the prior panels that has distinguished Hebrink in an unpublished basis because the rule of evidence were cited. That's sort of the easy out. Or this court can recognize that even if Hebrink were correctly decided when it was issued, it's been undermined by a subsequent decision of the Minnesota Supreme Court, specifically Gear, which holds that a motion is what it appears to be, not some downstream effects that it might have.
Counsel, Gear doesn't mention Hebrink, correct?
True.
And isn't Gear distinguishable because the letter in Gear was fully compliant with the relevant rules, whereas here the motion that was filed by Hybrid Light in the discussion of the exclusion of this evidence, there's no reference to the relevant rules. I mean, I think it's a stretch to say that Hebrink is overruled by Gear, but help me understand why you think that Gear overrules Hebrink. But more importantly, help me understand why this motion that was filed and the portion of the trial brief that relates to it is not really a de facto motion for summary judgment. Because when you look at it, you know, the discussion is a legal discussion. For example, it says here, Hybrink's warranty claims are as a matter of law, not affected by any purported warranty claim for several reasons. And then it discusses those reasons. And then the conclusion is whether or the last paragraph is whether disclaimer language is conspicuous is a question of law. So the emphasis of the motion was not on rules of evidence, relevancy, or prejudice. It was on the law surrounding conspicuousness and the terms of a contract. And I'm just really struggling to see how this motion really fits within the standard that or the applies the standard that would be applied for a typical motion in limine.
So a few responses to that set of questions, Your Honor. First, the very page, so plaintiff's pretrial brief contained all the motions in limine in a single document. And the page that has this argument cites Rule of Evidence 403 on the very same page. Now, to credit
Wait,
the premise,
where? Oh, I don't see that.
If you look at page four.
I see Rule 403, but that's in the discussion of a different issue. It's not in the discussion of this issue. That's in the discussion of whether the court should prohibit defendant from offering any evidence regarding alleged amounts due to defendant by hybrid. I think it's a stretch to say that the reference in 403 in that other provision somehow relates to this provision when it's really just not discussed.
Well, the cases, albeit unpublished, from this court that have discussed Hebrink seem to draw a bright line rule that if a rule of evidence is cited in the relevant document, it's outside of Hebrink. And there's no other contrary authority. Now, if there is to be a
in
new
the
rule
relevant
of law,
document discussing a completely different issue.
Well, so the cases applying Hebrink, in those cases, it appears that the motions in limine in those cases were filed as separate documents rather than as here where the trial judge wanted a single document. So the document that we're discussing cites Rule 403, but I want to acknowledge Your Honor is correct. 403 nor 401 nor 402 are cited in the particular section on the standard conditions. So that is true. But nonetheless, the conspicuousness, the legal argument on conspicuousness does go to relevancy. For two reasons. If it wasn't provided to hybrid, it by definition can't be conspicuous and it can't be relevant. And moreover, this is the issue of conspicuousness.
But isn't that a legal determination? That's not.
It is. And those sorts of threshold determinations on admissibility are legal ones for the trial judge properly made on motions in limine. And to circle back.
But is that a question of admissibility? It seems like it's a question of the availability of a defense, which is a summary judgment issue.
Two responses to that. One, this wasn't a summary judgment motion because it didn't seek to dispose of a claim. It sought to exclude evidence, and that was what it did. The fact that the downstream effect was that McAlty couldn't prevail on an affirmative defense doesn't convert this into a summary judgment motion.
Well, the motion did say to requested exclusion of evidence and arguments, any arguments regarding the damage limitations. So, I mean, that seemed to me to be an argument that they can't raise the defense or a request that they not raise the defense.
I acknowledge that the effect of granting the motion in limine precluded McAlty from raising the defense.
But counsel, I'm referring to what was expressly requested in the motion itself. Paragraph 2, prohibiting defendant from offering any evidence or making any arguments regarding the damage limitations in the standard conditions of sale buried in defendant's website. So it's not just offering the evidence, it's making any arguments regarding that limitation, the standard conditions, which is basically their defense.
The final sentence of the court's order granting the motion states, plaintiff's motion to exclude is granted. So this motion sought the exclusion of evidence. That's what the district court judge thought she was doing, and that's what she did. She did not enter summary judgment, and that's not what she believed she was doing.
Did she apply the appropriate legal standard? And if so, where is that analysis?
Yes, she did. In fact, so her discussion of the conspicuousness is found at addendum page 2 and addendum page 3, and she got that analysis basically right. As I think Judge Connolly referred to in the prior conversation, in the motion in limine briefing, it's made clear that McAlty was asked in discovery, which of your employees gave these standard conditions to hybrid and which hybrid employees received them. And in response to those interrogatory questions, McAlty gave no names and said, go look at our website. So on this record, again, even if this were treated as an improper summary judgment motion, McAlty had no evidence that anyone, no admissible evidence that anyone gave it to Hybrid or anyone at Hybrid received it. And in fact, the testimony of Weber can't support that either. That's sort of double hearsay. Weber saying that John provided these to Hybrid is, it's hearsay. Whatever actions John did or did not do, if John were here saying, I gave them to Hybrid, that might be admissible evidence. But Weber saying someone else who isn't anywhere in this appellate record did something or gave something to Hybrid is not admissible evidence on which a person can oppose summary judgment.
Mr. Flaherty, one of the arguments that Mr. Duncan was making is that he was deprived of an opportunity, essentially, to make an offer of proof at trial to support the defense because he was, for lack of a better word, ambushed by the motion in limine. You want to respond to that?
Yes. So first of all, the order granting the motion in limine excluded evidence from the jury. It didn't prohibit an offer of proof. And nor did Hybrid ask for a prohibition on an offer of proof. Secondly, the timeline doesn't bear this out. So motions in limine were filed on May 12th. Responses were filed on May 19th. And trial wasn't until June 12th. So if you look at the Hebrink decision, there were 7 days between motions in limine and the trial. And this court in Hebrink kind of suggested there might be some prejudice here. But on this appeal, we have 30 days, or a month, I should say, between May 12th, motions in limine, and June 12th, the beginning of trial. So even if we might say there were, that prejudice came about on, let's say, May 12th, McAlty had 30 days to do something, maybe a pretrial offer proof, an offer proof during trial.
Does the record indicate, Mr. Flaherty, that McAlty made a motion to reconsider this decision on the motion in limine?
To my knowledge, no, Your Honor.
Okay.
I don't believe so. Oh, and hypocrisy is sort of not the governing principle here, but I think it's important. The context is important if we're talking about potential prejudice or ambush. McAlty affirmatively moved in limine to have the standard conditions of sale applied against Hybrid. So, and that was denied, but McAlty asked the trial judge to say exclude indirect damages because they're barred by the standard conditions. So it's simply not consistent for McAlty to say that there was unfair surprise or prejudice about these terms and conditions, where McAlty is trying to use them affirmatively, sort of get them into evidence, and simultaneously Hybrid is trying to keep them out. I mean, both sides on May 12th knew that these standard conditions were in play, so to speak. And that's why you see them both discussed. Go ahead, Your Honor.
I'd like to discuss the issue of prejudice or alternatively harmless error, assuming that this was a de facto motion for summary judgment and the district court obviously did not expressly grant partial summary judgment. I should say partial summary judgment. But it did conduct a legal analysis of, to some extent, in its order. So assuming the district court did not apply the proper motion in limine standard, is McAlty prejudiced by not being able to present the defense based on the standard conditions of sale?
No, for a couple reasons, Your Honor. First, as the appellant, it's McAlty's burden to show what the prejudice was. And even here today, together, all of us at this late hour, none of us can point to a witness who had admissible testimony saying, I provided these standard conditions to Hybrid. That's nowhere here in the record. And so if McAlty wanted to preserve prejudice or harm in the appellate record, it would need to point to something today of saying this witness would have testified such and such at trial. And the hearsay of Tom Weber doesn't get them there. Moreover, there was no offer of proof, which is required under Rule of Evidence 103A2. And so that probably closely tracks the harmless error analysis in any event. But they weren't precluded from making an offer of proof where they should have come forth with a witness who said, I so-and-so provided these standard conditions to Hybrid. But the circumstantial evidence on this record shows no such witness exists, right? Because McAlty was asked that very question and their interrogatory answers identified no person. So the record on this appeal presently kind of suggests It never happened. Moreover, the standard conditions of sale themselves, I believe it's page 7, there's a page in there where the recipient of the standard conditions can sign an acknowledgement saying those were received. And that isn't in this record either. So even after multiple invoices and purchases, you know, there's a mechanism by which McAlty, as the seller, can generate this proof that the standard conditions were received. And that isn't in this record either. So we don't have anything in this record that looks like prejudice other than speculation.
Thank you.
I'm happy to continue answering questions from the panel or wrap up if panel members have no other questions.
Can you briefly address the argument relating to the special verdict form and whether it's inconsistent or there's an inconsistency there?
There is no inconsistency between the jury finding that an express promise was made and broken, but these generators were not unmerchantable. So that's comparing the first and the second counts. Those are different things. And nor is it inconsistent for the jury to find, as it apparently did with that the 20% negligence finding. The jury seems to have found that although Hybrid in fact believed the express promise of McAlty, it ought not to, right? There may have been some negligence in there. The jury believed, you know, Hybrid should have been more skeptical of the promise McAlty made. But under contract law, you have a promise breach damages. The partial 20% negligence of someone who entered into a contract is just not relevant for those damages. So there's no inconsistency.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, counsel. Mr. Duncan, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal if you choose to use it, sir.
Thank you. Just briefly, Your Honor, in terms of the getting back to the Hebrink issue, the trial court did not want the motions eliminated in any particular sort of way. It was Hybrid's decision to kind of lump them all in together. And we believe that it isn't a reasonable reading of that that motion to think that that is a motion in limine. It is, as what Hebron calls it, tantamount to a motion for summary judgment. They asked for they asked for a ruling as a matter of law. It did in fact dispose of a claim. Counsel said it didn't dispose of a claim. It disposed of an affirmative defense, which was our burden to prove, and it disposed of that because we were not allowed to bring that document in before the jury and explore that those defenses.
Mr. Duncan, what if they, well, let's say for the sake of argument, somehow Mr. Flaherty's client brought a motion for punitive damages, asked for punitive damages. You know, we're going to ask for punitive damages at trial. And you brought a motion in limine saying, well, as a matter of law, you can't get punitive damages because it's a contract case. Does that somehow suddenly make it a summary judgment motion? I mean, applied, but as a matter of law, I would have thought that's a motion in limine. And yes, you're applying the law, and, you know, to Judge Cochran's excellent point, you know, there's no talk about the probative effect and a prejudicial effect and no weighing, you know, like in Spriegel, but as a matter of law, you can't get them. So why can't they bring that as a, first of all, do you think they would have to bring that as a summary judgment motion, or you could bring it as a summary judgment motion as opposed to a motion in limine?
I think it could be brought as a summary judgment motion if they were.
Well, could you bring it as a motion in limine though? Let's say you didn't.
Yeah, if you brought it as a motion in limine, I think it might fall into one of those exceptions, or not exceptions, but the way some of those case non-published decisions were distinguished from Hebrink. I just don't think that's that example, though, Your Honor, is on all fours with the facts that we have here. I just think the facts we have here are just more akin to the situation in Hebrink than they are to, you know, Hang, for example, when you're talking about the statute of frauds, and the statute of frauds would seem to me to be kind of an evidentiary issue. And I think that's you know, or can be in that context. And I think that's why that case is distinguished from Hebrink. But Hebrink is, you know, you still have to, if you're bringing this motion and you're not arguing evidentiary rulings and you're not arguing prejudice or irrelevant, or that it's irrelevant, and you're simply arguing the merits of why it shouldn't be, why it's not a valid disclaimer, I think that is a summary judgment motion. It seems like a summary judgment motion. It sounds like one. It has the same effect of it. I just don't think it's a
well, if eliminates. Fair enough. Okay, if that's the case, then how do you respond to Mr. Flaherty's argument that, you know, shame on you, you were asking as a matter of law to allow us to make this argument, and why shouldn't that have been done on summary judgment?
I don't fault Hybrid's counsel for making the effort and making the argument. I think there's one thing as a litigator, trial lawyer, and you know, an advocate to make the argument. It's, you know, it's another thing for the court to you know, accept that argument in total and award and dismiss basically an entire affirmative defense that was essential to McAuliffe's defense in this case. And I think that's where the error lies. And I guarantee you that if the situation was reversed, Hybrid's counsel would probably be here citing Hebrink and the fact that our motion was an improper summary judgment motion.
Counsel, I just want to be clear on what you're asking this court to do. You're asking on that issue, you're asking this court to reverse and remand for a new trial.
Correct, Your Honor. I am doing that. And I'm almost out of time, but I'd be remiss if I didn't say that obviously our other arguments, you know, the evidentiary argument and the lack of any proof by Hybrid of what actually caused these failures. We're asking for the court to reverse the ruling on the judgment as a matter of law on that issue. As to other issues, new trial. Thank you, Your Honors.
Anything else from the panel? Counsel, thank you very much. Your arguments were very helpful today. When the matter is submitted, we'll issue an opinion within the statutory time period. Thank you very much. Have a good day. We're adjourned.